I'm Ron Olson, one of the directors for the group, and I appreciate everyone coming out. As you know, we meet on the second and fourth Tuesday of every month, and so we've got two more, let's see, today's the 24th, we've got two more presentations for this. You can't hear me? Really? This mic is kind of...
It's better now.
Is that better?
Okay.
All right. So we have two more presentations coming up after Dr. Gandy, and one of them is Dr. Gerald Schilling, right back here with you're with Eastfield. You'll be speaking about Karl Marx. No, Adam Smith. Adam Smith. One of those guys. One of those famous guys.
Easily confused.
Yes. So if you haven't paid already, the series, each lecture is $5. Jack Youngkin, can you raise your hand? That's our treasurer. So if you haven't paid, please do so after the meeting. And students with an ID, any students here tonight?
Yes.
Okay, several. It's just $2 for you gentlemen. Where y'all go to school?
Southwestern.
Okay, Southwestern Medical School?
No, my son was at God University.
Okay, awesome. That's great. Okay. So if you want to be a subscriber, the cost is $35 for 6 months. And also, make sure you pay for your meals as you leave and tip your wait staff accordingly, generously, please, if possible. We also want to finalize, we're going to be finalizing and working more on our fall sessions, fall schedule. And so Dallas Foster Swarm is working on that. We have to start working on that right now. So I would now ask you to please turn off your cell phones, put them on pleasure or vibrate mode. And now I'd like to introduce our speaker. Tonight's speaker is Dr. Woody Gandy. Dr. Gandy is a graduate of UT Southwestern Medical School and completed his residency in internal medicine at the University of California in Sacramento and San Francisco. He spent many years practicing emergency medicine and is currently an angel investor and a dilettante. He's a self-proclaimed dilettante in many areas. A special area of interest for Dr. Gandy is Buddhism. His topic this evening is exploring contemporary thoughts in Buddhist philosophy. And so now please join me in welcoming Dr. Woody Gandy.
Is this on?
It should be on. You're on.
Is that, everybody hear that okay? It doesn't sound very loud.
Keep going.
Testing 1, 2, 3, 4. Testing 1, 2, 3, 4. That's getting a little louder, I guess. Can you hear me yet? Everybody hear me pretty well? Okay, great. So, live by the sword, die by the sword. I was just panicking a little as my technology was not wanting to work, but at the last second it came together, so I'm happy about that. So, thanks for having me talk today. I'm excited to get to talk about Buddhism. The title is a little bit, I have to change it just a little bit, because if I tried to just talk about contemporary thoughts in Buddhism, that would be a little odd, because you couldn't really do that without tying into Buddhist thought all the way back to the time of the Buddha. So what I'm really going to do is look at Buddhist philosophy over the last 2,500 years, but from a contemporary perspective. This is a philosophy club, and so we're interested in philosophy, and I am going to challenge and look at some of these Buddhist principles from a philosophical perspective. I'm not really presenting this as a Buddhist, somebody Buddhist proselytizing Buddhism. I'm here to look at it from lots of different angles, and I hope that when we're done that you'll have questions and we can have a nice discussion. This could take quite a while to cover all this, so unfortunately I'm going to have to ask that we try not to have questions unless they're like a real clarification or a question that I wasn't clear about until the end of the talk. Now, why am I even qualified to stand here and talk about this? Well, that's a good question. You know, the real Buddhist experts weren't available, so you got me. My experience is about 5 years duration. It started after a trip to Thailand just developed an interest in this. Encountered a video series about Buddhism, watched that, and then became more interested. So over the last 5 years, I've done a lot of reading. I've probably read about 15 books on Buddhism. Some of them are more popular type books, like Thich Nhat Hanh's books. Others are more technical and philosophically oriented. And particularly tonight, one that I'm going to rely on a lot that I recommend is this book by Mark Sideritz, who's a philosopher, a professor of philosophy at a university here in the United States. I'll have to recall where he's at. But this Buddhism as Philosophy is a great, very clear discussion of Buddhism from a philosophical perspective. So knowing that I'm not a lama or a Buddhist monk or, you know, I have a big priority here. That is, I'm going to try very hard not to introduce any of my own original ideas into this. I'm going to try to be very accurate and disciplined about that, because I think that would be a tempting thing to just start, you know, spouting off. So what are the questions that people ask about Buddhism? Is Buddhism even a religion? And that really depends on what we consider a religion to be. If a religion is a system of beliefs surrounding a god, then Buddhism would not be a religion. If a religion is an endeavor directed toward issues of salvation, soteriology, philosophical terms, soteriology, then Buddhism would be a religion. And it seems to me that soteriology is core and central to all religions. I mean, if you look at Christianity, the core of Christianity is the idea of salvation by accepting Jesus Christ as your Savior. So it's all about salvation. Buddhism is all about salvation. So I think in that sense, we could definitely consider it a religion. Now, is it a science? It's not a science, of course. This goes all the way back to 2,500 years ago. And they, during the course of Buddhist thought, they got into a lot of scientific types of inquiries, more like theoretical physics, armchair science, thinking, which is really what metaphysics is for philosophers. So what we will discover, though, in this talk is it's astounding to see how close they came in many respects to what we have found then later through the scientific method in many areas of inquiry. So I think we're going to find that to be very interesting. But remember, this is philosophy. We're in a philosophy club. We're here to entertain these sort of mind-bending ideas, and this is very mind-bending. It sort of reminds me a little of some college dormitory discussions that we might have. And it ties in pretty nicely to the last lecture we had, which was some pretty mind-bending stuff as well. But you kind of have to suspend your expectation. If we try to compare all this to science, we may miss, or judge it against scientific standards, we may miss some important insights that we want to get from this. So kind of keep that in mind too. Now, people ask me, am I a Buddhist? And the problem with that question is that there are many kinds of Buddhism, many strains of Buddhism, and many beliefs within Buddhism, many perspectives to it. And I have found some of these to be very useful and intriguing and enough to keep me going and continuing to go to, you know, retreats. Went to a week-long retreat with the Thich Nhat Hanh group, and other, you know, shorter retreats keep me reading. So I find it very interesting. So in a way, I guess I am, to some extent, a Buddhist. Personally, I don't embrace the idea of rebirth. I see karma as an important concept, and in many ways I see karma in the world, but I don't necessarily see it like early Buddhists did. I have questions about nirvana. So I'm not really, you know, classic Buddhists. That gives you a little perspective there. Now, Buddhism arose in a context. The context was, at that time, in India, there were a lot of beliefs already in place. Some of these beliefs
are today are associated with Buddhism, but are not really necessarily the core beliefs of Buddhism. So there are beliefs surrounding Buddhism related to gods, number of gods, but they're not core to Buddhism, and they were there before Buddhism arose. The idea of removing yourself from desires and attachments in the world was there before Buddhism arose. Rebirth was accepted by everyone at that time in that region, and so that was just a given, just a context. Those things are not necessarily core to Buddhism, although Buddhism, in one way, really makes use of rebirth in those early early thinking. So we'll get into all that. Now, with Buddhism, there's many writings that have over the years. I can't say that I've read all these original texts, the sutras and Vinayas, and all the original works that are out there. If so, I'd have a PhD in Buddhism. But I've read a lot of the contemporary works that review those. Now we talked a little bit about soteriology, the study of salvation, why Buddhism is perhaps a religion on that basis. And I want you to remember, as we talk about the philosophy of Buddhism, that it gets out a little abstract and a little bit mind-twisting, as I said, but it has a purpose. From the square one all the way through, this philosophy was directed to the soteriological purpose. So part of the Buddhist path is the idea that you would gain wisdom about the nature of things. Philosophy is part of that, is a key part of that. In fact, Buddhism may be the only religion that has a major pillar that you need to do philosophy. To follow this Buddhist path, one third of it is really philosophical. Doing philosophy, thinking, pondering, meditating on philosophical issues. Just a few prefaces to kind of set the tone, and we'll get going. You may have heard of Theravada Buddhism. Theravada today is practiced in a lot of Southeast Asia and is the today's carry forward of the original conservative forms of Buddhism. There was around the time of Christ or 0 CE, the Mahayana Buddhist movement came on the scene and is the forerunner of many traditions today like Zen Buddhism. There's another, the third big category of Buddhism is Vajrayana, which is the Tibetan Buddhism, and it takes many features from other strains in that area, such as Tantra and Yoga. So these each have different characteristics, but we're going to be talking, we'll kind of, you'll see to some extent, primarily we're going to talk about the beliefs that are common to Theravada and the other two, and then the Mahayana trends that came forward. Now, the Buddha, there are several names we hear. So the Buddha is also known as Shakyamuni Buddha. Shakyamuni Buddha is the wise man of the Shakya tribe. But he was also just called the Buddha, and his name actually was Siddhartha Gautama. So he was born into a well-to-do family, and left that family to go out and follow the tradition that was prevalent at that time of seeking wisdom, going out and trying to find a spiritual path.
Is it asceticism?
Asceticism is one of those traditions that they would follow. They weren't all ascetics.
He did
go that way. He first adopted asceticism as his spiritual path. That didn't work. He then he had already had the experience in growing up as a wealthy young prince, essentially, of great luxury and pleasure. So I could talk a long time about the historical aspects and the mythological aspects but I don't want to take too much time on that because I want to get to the philosophical aspects. So let me just say, suffice it to say that he went off on a spiritual quest, left his family, left his luxury, and ended up founding a great religion. Now, this his religion, his thought processes are based on what's called the Four Noble Truths. What he said is that human life, human existence, is imbued with suffering. Now, the word suffering was translated. When we use the word suffering, we think of it means something to us. For it's probably not the proper translation. What he was really talking about was a underlying discontent, dissatisfaction, lack of peace that gave rise to lots of activities that cause harm. And really, it's sort of like existential angst. It's an awareness of mortality and a disquiet based on that. And in his view, that's what caused people to go out and conquer other kingdoms and cause all sorts of havoc in the world. So that was his first of the Four Noble Truths. The second was that this was caused, he knew the cause. The cause was related to attachment, but we'll get to that later. And the third was that he had a solution, and the fourth was the solution, which is actually the Eightfold Path in Buddhism. I'm doing this talk a little differently than many people approach Buddhism. I'm going to save that for the last. And I'm going to launch into the philosophical part of Buddhism. And so I'm stealing a little something from This American Life, Ira Glass, where they do an acts. So act one is the self. And what we need to do to talk about the self, and this is because this is where it all started with Siddhartha Gautama, is the self. We need to understand how we talk about identity, qualitative versus quantitative identity. So, qualitative identity means that two things are alike, exactly alike in all respects. They are the same qualitatively. Quantitative identity means they are the same thing. So we could have two absolutely identical things that are not the same. Now, this is in the world of ideas. If we're in the world of space and time, we might say two things can't occupy the same space. So spatially, that's a quality they have. So they could not be quantitatively different and qualitatively the same if you consider where they're located. But from a analytic approach, quantitative, qualitative identity, pretty straightforward. So we can now use that to define what we mean by a self. So the self is a numerically distinct entity that distinguishes each person, or any sentient entity if you wish to look at it that way, from another, and must continue to exist for that person or entity to continue to exist. That's usually a pretty reasonable definition of what most people think of when they think of a self. It's that thing that makes you you and that has to be there to continue for you to continue to be there and be you. So, in different cultures, we have different ideas of the self, whether they're qualitatively or quantitatively distinct. And there are some Indian schools that believe they are not qualitatively distinct, that all selves are the same, but we're not going to get into that. That'd be a whole other talk. Christian, we're mostly familiar with in the West, would say that selves are qualitatively distinct and quantitatively distinct as well. Now, in Hinduism, we had the idea of the Atman, which is a self that continues from life to life. And so this is sort of in the traditional, and a lot of thinking in the West too, we think of reincarnation and going back to past lives and such. Buddhism, one of the big break-offs of Buddhism from Hinduism at that time was Anatma, not a self, no self. So they differed from the Hindu perspective in regard to Atma, the self. Now, what was the argument for that the Buddha made? He made an argument, now, that he, this is from sort of meditation, introspection, that what he saw was that an individual is comprised of these five things. Now, you notice, like, the soul is not listed there. He didn't list that because he didn't see that in his introspection. So this is what he saw as comprising a person. The body, which is the rupa, and then in Pali, and the other four are sort of the non-physical aspects, which were called the nama rupa, collectively. Sensation. Now these have somewhat technical terms. So sensation is sort of a sense of positive, negative, neutral orientation to a stimulus or a thought. It's really just positive, negative, or neutral. So it's really on a scale. Perceptions, the six senses, they considered the mind to be a sense. That would be the sixth sense. So the eye receives visual information and creates visual perception and consciousness related to that. The mind does the same thing, but by creating thoughts. That's just how they kind of conceptualize it. Mental formations, also called volitions, in this conceptualization, are basically conditioning. So it would be memories, preconditioning, orientations, all the things that make you react in a certain way to perceptions or thoughts. And then consciousness is, in this view of things, it's really sort of a higher order awareness. So you may have visual perceptions that get visual input, that get visual perceptions, and then there'd be visual consciousness related to that. This is kind of what I was just saying about each sense then giving rise to its own type of consciousness. Now, so his arguments against the self were that, first of all, under the principle of likeness, and that is sort of the Occam's razor of the Eastern culture, which is that you should not postulate something that you don't need to explain what you see. And so under the principle of likeness, he didn't see a self. He saw these components, but he didn't see anything else. Then there are two major arguments. The argument from impermanence says a self, if it's permanent, if it's, remember how we defined a self, that thing that needs to be there to continue to be there for, you know, for you to be you and continue to exist as you, he said none of these things are permanent. All these, the body is not permanent, it changes, and we now know scientifically it changes constantly. It turns over. Perceptions are not constant, they change. Consciousness, sensation, all those things that were in his skandhas. And by the way, you might not really think that's the right grouping with the skandhas. It doesn't matter, make whatever grouping you want. He's saying that the impermanence, none of them are permanent. The second argument is argument from control, that you would figure that the self would be the constant actor that controls things. That would be naturally what we think of as a self. What he observed is that these different components are in control at different times. That they vary. It's a shifting control, sort of like on a Survivor, where different groups gang up and overpower other people and such. So he saw it as a very dynamic process and not one where there was a constant actor. That's the argument from control. So this view of the self or the mind is not exactly the same as how neuroscientists today view it, but it's in the same ballpark. And it's remarkable that this is before CAT scans and MRIs and, you know, all this kind of stuff, 2,500 years ago, that he just came up with this through his, you know, thinking about it. Now, this is the middle way. The middle way is talked about a lot in Buddhism. In one sense, it was his finding that a life of pleasure versus a life of asceticism, neither was the answer. And then the middle way is used many other places. And this is also used that way, that annihilationism would be the idea that there is a self that is instantaneously existing, but destroyed and a new self created, and a new self, and a new self, and a new self. Eternalism is that there is a constant self. That would be more consistent with the Christian perspective of the soul. Non-self is neither of those. It's saying there's not a self that is there for an instant and then a new self. It's saying that there's really not just, that the idea of a self is illusory. It's not something that's really there. Now, how would you square that with rebirth? That is kind of, we talk about that a lot. I don't think I want to, but it's like a flame. The idea they had was that it's like a flame that spreads from branch to branch, from life to life, and the flame is never the same at one moment to the next. That's a little bit like annihilationism, but I find it hard for them to square this with their belief in rebirth. Now, in the West, Western philosophy, David Hume came to a similar perspective, and Hume may have had contact with Buddhists. He may have gotten it, but you could, you know, he had very similar perspective. For my part, when I enter in most differently what I call myself, I always double up some particular perception or other of heat or cold, light or shade, love or hatred, pain or pleasure. I can never catch myself at any time without a perception, and never can observe anything but the perception. If anyone upon serious and prejudiced reflection thinks he has a different notion of himself, I must confess I can reason no longer with him. All I can allow him is that he may be in the right as well as I, and that we are essentially different in this particular. I'm not going to read the rest because I need to keep moving here. So, that's Act 1. Act 2 is Dharmas. Now, the first few hundred years after Buddha was alive, this stuff was all transmitted orally, not written down. But then it all began to get written down around 0 CE or a little before. It appeared in writing. And I think, you know, 100 or 200 years before 0 CE, it kind of began to appear. And this was called the Abhidharma period. The Abhidharma texts came into play at this time, which are, so the first period of Buddhism is the is what the Buddha himself said, and it's reflected in the sutras. So the sutras are sort of scripture in Buddhism. They are what the Buddha said purportedly, handed down orally and then written down. The Abhidharma texts are commentaries and further extensions and extrapolations of that line of thinking. So, these texts represent the work of new philosophers from various schools of thought at that time. And they were taking this whole issue of the self and saying, wow, you know, if there's not really a self like we've been thinking all this time, well, what does exist? We see that the idea that the self is made up of these parts, well, how does that play with other things? And this, again, was to explore this in the Buddhist path, because the idea that you've got to get this internalized, you've got to really absorb this and really get it in your bones. And so they felt this continued exploration philosophically was important. So, we're going to talk about this concept they have of mirological reductionism. And that idea is that it's a little bit like nominalism for universals, but this is about wholes and parts. And so, we here have a bicycle. It has a number of parts in relation. And I'm taking this, by the way, really a lot from Mark Siderit's book, because he just does a great exposition of it. So the question is, do the wholes exist? Do whole things exist? Or are they sort of illusory created in our minds? And there are four possibilities here. holes and parts are real. Holes are real, but parts are not real. Neither holes nor parts are real. Or holes are not real and parts are real. It's kind of four possibilities between two things. So we're going to look at this and consider, you know, if we can knock out a couple of these pretty quickly. So number two, we could pretty much knock out, that's monism. And there are schools of thought that that are monist, but it kind of fails to explain experience, because if there's just one big thing, then I could have beliefs just as well as IST, and it's just, you know, but we don't observe that. So monism kind of fails. So we'll go on from there. So we've knocked out number two as a monist thing. And so number three, that's metaphysical nihilism. Because number three says there's nothing, no holes, no parts, there's no... Well, then how are we asking the question? You know? So that's kind of... that's pretty knocked out there. And so then we can go on to looking at the first one, the first question. Holes and parts are both real. Now, we can break that into two possible perspectives. Holes and parts in relation are real, and the whole is identical to the parts in relation. But that we can knock out by what's called the principle of indiscernibility, or Leibniz's law, which says that two things that are qualitatively the same, let's see, whole parts in relation are real, and the whole is identical to the parts in relation. So if they're quantitatively identical, they cannot be qualitatively distinct. And these are qualitatively distinct because a whole is a whole and parts in relation are parts in relation. So that one is out by what's called Leibniz's law. So now we can look at 1b. Wholes and parts in relation are real, and the whole is distinct from the parts in relation. Now that one's a lot of people kind of think that way. That, you know, their parts and their wholes, they're all real. If we disprove that, we're left with number four, which is holes are not real, parts are real. So the argument against 1B, this is a position held by an Indian, prominently by an Indian school, the Nyaya school. But you know, what separate evidence exists for these holes that is separate from the evidence for the existence of the parts in relation? We don't see that evidence, so the principle of Leibniz comes into play. Where is the whole? Well, a couple of possibilities here. The whole is partly in each part or entirely in each part. But if the whole is partly in each part, then the bicycle exists separately from its parts, and itself has parts. What this does, I'm afraid I'm going to run out of time if I just take too long on this stuff, but that is a recursive, infinite recursive loop that you end up infinitely postulating a series of seats. We can come back to that if we want to, but I think I'm kind of getting short on time. If the whole is entirely in each part, that means each part has bicycleness, so it's sort of like universal. But if we examine only one part, can we detect this bicycleness? If we examine a thread, do we detect the clothness, that is there clothness in a thread? So they say no, that's an illusion. This is how we get to the Buddhist argument that holes are really something we project onto what are parts. We project holes. In that sense, they are illusory. They're convenient designators for relationships. And there's an argument about whether relationships exist, because relationships have to be connected to the things they relate, and that again gets you to a recursive loop where you keep connecting the relationship to the connector. So a lot of these things are just sort of like making, they're sort of shaking us up. They're not intuitive. Our normal daily experience doesn't bring into question whether there's a car that's going to run over me. You know, there's a car. You know, but these are trying to shake us up. So we get out of our sort of mundane, convenient way of viewing the world. And this is called mirological reductionism. This is where they ended up, that to exist, a thing must be non-partite, indivisible, with an essence not derived from other things. So they call these the dharmas. Now, dharma, that's with a small d. Dharma with a big d in Buddhism is the teaching of the Buddha in general, so the truth of the universe, the Buddhist path, everything that the Buddha said is sort of the truth, and that's dharmas with a big D, dharma with a big D. Now, I should say at this moment, though, that in Buddhism, Buddha is not viewed as anything other than a human being who was really smart and really did a lot of introspective, meditative work. Not viewed as above human or superhuman, or not like, you know, Christ would be in Christianity, nothing like that. And even the Buddha, at the time he was teaching, challenged his students to question him, to challenge him, and said that there's nothing I'm telling you that you can't figure out on your own. So this is not revealed truth. This is. In Buddhism, the idea is it should be truth that one arrives at through analytic thought. But, of course, then we have to, it's hard to get out of this way of thinking that we have. So, at that time, there was a theory of an atomic theory. And this whole thing of this mineralogical reductionism kind of came into conflict. You know, they really had a pretty good atomic theory. They didn't have any idea of electrons and protons and neutrons, but they were talking about atoms. And they said, there's this smallest thing that must exist. There's this smallest non-divisible thing called an atom. And so they kind of got into this argument with the Buddhists, the Satyatika school, and about mereological reductionism. So the Satyatika said, well, you know what? We haven't seen any evidence of these atoms. Of course, that's a weak argument because, okay, you don't have any electron microscopes, you know. But they had a better argument. Spatial location as a quality. And so you know what they said was, there's a problem with the idea of atoms. Because no matter how, if the atom occupies space, if it occupies any space, then it's got parts. It's got a top and a bottom and a right and a left or a front and a back or something. If it occupies any space. So they said, that can't be. That cannot be the smallest part. Cannot be something that occupies space. And they said, so, wow, you know, that means nothing can really exist. I mean, how does it occupy space? So they concluded that it would have to be the qualities. The thing itself can still be divided down to a smaller and smaller thing after you get to a point. So it must be just that qualities are real, but not things. So they actually came up with this theory, and they had this whole big Dharma theory line of reasoning, and they came up with all this kind of armchair list of different dharmas, what they all were, solidity and lightness and heat and all these different things, which later Buddhist philosophers would say, wow, you've gotten way off. Buddha did not want you going off into this dividing things up. But that was there. But now let's fast forward. This is what's very interesting. Fast forward to the early 1960s. And there was a physicist named Murray Gell-Mann. He was sitting there looking at subatomic particles and proposed a method for organizing subatomic particles that he sort of whimsically called the Eightfold Way, after the Buddhist Eightfold Path. And he must have had some awareness. This system, the Eightfold Way, led to the discovery of quarks and leptons, which are today considered the most fundamental particles. And he got the Nobel Prize in 1969 for that. And here's the interesting thing. Quarks and leptons have no size. They occupy no space. They are just qualities, like topness, bottomness, strangeness. They're little bundles of qualities, and so in that sense you might say, well, they're quark-type, but any, you know, a quark with certain types of qualities would be one quark. It's still non-spatial, just qualities. So it's amazing how these guys sitting there in their armchairs, if they had those, they're sitting on their spoons back in 2,000 years ago, kind of came to a similar thing. It shows how just thinking can take you places that you may go with the scientific method at a later date. But other philosophers, now this is where we get to Act 3, emptiness. Now this is with the rise of the Mahayana movement in the first century. This whole idea of Dharma started to be challenged. So this Buddhist philosophy is sort of a history of each thing being kind of thrown out as not being sufficient to explain reality.
Hmm.
So in this Mahayana, Mahayana, I always have trouble pronouncing these things, movement, there were two most prominent schools. One we're not going to talk much about is the Yogacara school. It was really idealist. They said reality is ineffable. It's not something we could describe. We cannot really know reality because we only know what we're thinking. The object of our thoughts is mental. The object of our knowledge is mental. So it's sort of we're separate from reality. And they said furthermore that karma is really what determines human experience. And they really kind of developed a whole argument that it's not the laws of physics, it's not the laws of the world, it's karma. And you have to reconcile some really strange things like, how did karma bring me and this waiter together today? You know, how is it that we saw each other today? If karma is discovering everything, it is controlling everything. And it's essential, this Yogacara school does absolutely require a belief in rebirth, or that school's perspective totally falls apart. So that's very essential. But they were basing this on on this idea that is throughout Buddhism and all the way back from even before the Mahayana movement started, which is called representationalism. And it's one aspect of non-dualism, which is a principle in Buddhism that whenever you divide things and see that there's two opposing things, that you've missed the boat somehow. And representationalism says is that the seer, the seeing, and the seen are all one thing. And the same for all the other senses and perceptions. And in a way, you can say that's true, because the object of your intentionality, the thing you think you're seeing, is really that image, is something that's been constructed from nerve impulses coming into your brain. Here's this image. The image is really a mental thing. The seeing is obviously then to that. And what they're saying also is the seer is the same thing, because this idea of consciousness being related to the specific perception that we have. I'm perceiving this one thing, that's my consciousness. So consciousness is fragmented in the Buddhist perspective. It's fragmented and comprised of many different parallel threads of consciousness at one time. So the Majjhimagga school said, wait a minute though. So now they're reacting to Satchatikas and others that came before that got off into the Dharma analysis, Dharma theory. And so they said, well look, all Dharmas, this is wrong. These Dharmas you think that exist, all these categorizing Dharmas, they are empty of essence. You said Dharmas have to have an indivisible essence. The Majjhimagga said, well guess what, nothing has that. Nothing has that. And so they're basically denying the existence of dharmas. They still use the word, but they'll say dharmas are empty of essence, which kind of negates the idea of it being a dharma. And their method is not to offer an alternative perspective, because their viewpoint is, you're not going to figure it out, that we can't figure this out. And in this way, it's like, I'm going to draw a parallel, say, in Christianity, or other theist perspectives, that God is inscrutable, or that this is beyond something that you would be able to conceptualize. So it has to do with the limits of not only of language, which because we think in language, but it's also the limit of concepts. Concepts are not good enough. So when you get to Zen Buddhism, it's sometimes considered to be anti-intellectual, because they promote the idea that don't think about things. Just be it. Feel it. to be it. And so the Major Micah School, their approach was to really undermine anything you wanted to try to say about reality. And they used these reductio ad absurdum arguments to do that. And I'm going to go through a few of them really quick with you. I liked, however, this for the New World Encyclopedia about emptiness. It's also called sunyata. It's a key concept to express that everything one encounters in life is empty of absolute identity, permanence, or an indwelling self, because everything is interrelated and mutually dependent, never wholly self-sufficient or independent. So for them to be pursuing this line of thinking, they would have to kind of come from the Dharma theory tradition to react against it and to start, you know, carrying this line down. So, now emptiness is not non-existence. It's not meaninglessness, valuelessness, hopelessness, or monism. It's none of these things. It's just what I said, that there are no things that have their own essence. Now, the founder of the Majjhimaka school was Nagarjuna, and he was prominently active. He lived in 152-50 CE, and he wrote this long named book, which is often abbreviated to MMK, and there's three sections to the name, called The Fundamental Verses of the Middle Way. And so let's take the first example argument that they would make about this. This is the idea that there can be no, it's an argument that comes from causes and conditions. And I want to just start with an example here. Because I want to use, they used examples of like the seed and the sprout. David Hume, again, who I'm really thinking had contact with this Buddhist stuff, he talked about milk, the curds in the milk, and you know the progression to in that sense. But those are distracting because we're going to all start saying, "Oh, but you know, that's they didn't have enough. They didn't know about science." So I'm going to go right to something that's modern, which is the subatomic particles collide, and two other particles fly away, and a photon arises. Okay, so we can't argue that one. They just didn't know. The assertions they make is that an effect is distinct from the cause and conditions. So that's to say that we might say energy equals mass times speed of light squared, but that doesn't mean energy and mass are the same. I mean, they're not exactly the same, or we wouldn't even be able to distinguish that there are things we call mass. So that means, they said, the effect is therefore not in the cause and conditions, or it would just already be seen there. The effect, if real, cannot be the product of the causes and conditions, because to say a thing is a product is to say that it derives its nature from something else. And so the effect, if it's a dharma, this is really, if the effect is something that's real, could not be that either. This stuff, by the way, I know this, I'm dashing through this stuff, and I realize it's kind of hard to absorb this quickly. I know it's tough. Tell you, you have to... What they say is that you really have to spend your whole life in a monastery meditating on this stuff to really get it. So, they said the effect cannot be brought about by a cause or force distinct from the causes and conditions, because we would then need to postulate a relationship between the cause or forces and the causes and conditions, and in fact, and the effect. But what then relates the relationship? You just get into this infinite recursive deeper and deeper, each relationship has to be related to the other. This idea of this criticism of relationships, F.H. Bradley pursued this. He's a British idealist and made arguments about against relationships. I finally kind of got it, but those of you who are understanding this as fast as I'm going through it, I'm really impressed, because I would not. It took me a long time to sit there and think, what? But anyhow, that's a recursive argument. So the conclusion was, and this is what Nagarjuna said in MMK 1, never from itself, not from another, not from both, nor without cause, never, in any way, is there any existing thing that has arisen. This is mind-twisting stuff. Example number two, another argument they made about time and movement. And I just before I make that argument, I want to point out, just here's Einstein. He said, people like us who believe in physics know that the distinction between past, present, and future is only a stubborn, persistent illusion. So we have, again, a kind of tie into modern physics. Their argument was, well, movement cannot be possible. So they're kind of undermining anything we think is like obvious. And the three times argument is one they made. They said, look, if we consider that a locus, that the timeline has various locuses, and we know that there's no movement at the current time point, there could be no movement at the preceding or the future point. I mean, really what this is doing is it's kind of destroying the idea of time and instead looking at it as snapshots. And in a snapshot, there's not movement. So they're saying, really, it's snapshots. Everything is a series of snapshots. And that's really what Einstein was saying. The mind, there must be a mind to integrate moments to perceive motions. Motion cannot, and so it's illusory. It cannot be an intrinsic nature, and hence cannot be real. So, this is the idea that though I'm standing here and I'm seeing something moving, what I really am is just an instant, and I have in my brain various information from what came before and what's now, and I'm putting it all together and saying movement. But what they're saying is those are all separate existences, separate slices. The only thing that connects them is you thinking it. The other argument was about what they call contingent and essential properties. So assume that going is occurring at the present moment. The timeline of the present moment then has an essential property of being a point in time and a contingent property of being a locus of going. So they're saying that that's a mental construct because it doesn't have its own essence. So this gives rise to what is known in Buddhism as the doctrine of momentariness, and it's related to the doctrine of dependent origination. So it's the idea that when you see the arrow, it's not one arrow, it's many. And that what is now gives rise to what is next, but there's kind of separate slices, separate things. A third argument, space and its content. They said, look, this is space and the contents in space are disallowably mutually dependent. The relationship of each point in space to various contents of space distinguishes the spatial points. That's the only thing that makes one point in space different from another is the relationship those points have to the contents of space. But the relationship of otherwise identical content in space, those things are distinguished only by their relationship to the points in space. So it's like this circular thing that is disallowable. And so, again, all these Buddhist arguments, the thing that's kind of cool about them is you can sit there and you can think about these things until your mind hurts, and you can't totally dismiss them, you know? You look at them and you say, well, that is crazy. But you can't quite totally just say it's totally wrong, because there's something about it that sort of, you know, makes you a little, throws you off a little bit. So, there's our points in our space. Now, Nagarjuna talked about relativity and emptiness. Nothing has intrinsic essence. So tallness is only related to shortness. And this reminds me of relativity and Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. So this is from Wikipedia. I thought it was good. But I'm going to skip it because I want you to see the last. That which is the element of space is seen to exist on account of form. That's what I just talked about. So that's just another, just thought that was a nice excerpt, that last pink part, kind of again said the same thing. So Nagarjuna said, this is from MMK, whatever is dependently co-arisen, that is explained to be emptiness. That, being a dependent designation, is itself the middle way. Now what does that mean? Boy, that is strange stuff. Okay. He's saying it's a dependent designation. So he's talking about emptiness. He says, well, the idea of emptiness has no essence. Emptiness is dependent on other things to even talk about emptiness. Like tall, you can't talk about tallness without shortness. You can't talk about emptiness without non-emptiness. So he's saying, you know what? Emptiness is not, it's itself is empty. So you kind of get these recurrent, that's sort of a, this is why, again, it's basically he's saying even this, even these thoughts of what, this is not the ultimate truth. Emptiness is not the ultimate truth. The middle way, again, they keep using this idea of the middle way throughout Buddhism in many different contexts. And basically what they're saying is it's neither nihilist nor realist. So again, it's sort of, the middle way is always something other than what you're, what you set as the context. The context is wrong. The assumptions are wrong. You know? So in Buddhism, you have this idea of conventional truth, which is, we say that there is a car. I want to pick it up. Give me my car. Ultimate truth, which is all the way now to emptiness. But there's something beyond that. They're saying nothing we've come up with, even we, the brilliant guys of the Majjhimakas, who tear down everything else, even our thoughts are not, can't stand, really. And so in Buddhism, they'll talk about thusness. You know, just don't think about it, just be it. Just feel it. And there are positive statements. Now, emptiness often comes across sort of negatively to us, because it's like, sounds like, ugh, empty. I don't want to be empty. That sounds like depression or something like that. That's not the use of it. And there have been attempts to kind of convert this to positive statements. Way back all through the ages, this idea of Buddha nature. Buddha nature says, what I really am is connected with everything. I'm not separate. I have no essence. There's no essence in me. I am just, like everything else, part of everything. And what keeps me from realizing that and becoming a Buddha is all this illusory stuff that I'm surrounded with, all this distracting illusions. And so they say the Buddha nature is there. Thich Nhat Hanh uses the term interbeing. So trying to get a positive twist on it. So now, you might be able to think about the koan that they've used in Zen Buddhism. You know, koan practice, in addition to meditation, is part of the what they do try to shake us out of our normal thinking and get us to progress down the Buddhist path. And so they'll give you these kind of little puzzles. So Buddha nature is aboriginal. That means, as I just described what Buddha nature is, if you conceive of it as being something that's there but only obscured by illusion, it's been there all along, and we believe in rebirth. If we're Buddhist and we, you know, if you believe in rebirth, you'd have to say it's there in the dog, it's all the way back. You know, Buddha nature is an all sentient thing. So they say, well, does the dog have Buddha nature? And this is, it's really a little story about a Buddhist master was asked, and he said, wu. Now, wu in Chinese really kind of means no or non-existent. He said, well, how can this is contradictory. This can't be true. And so you can think about that. I have the answer, but I won't tell you. So now, I didn't like Act 4 because that sounds strange, and so I had to come up with something else for the fourth part here. And so it's Act 0 because everything from the start, from zero, pace zero, is all about salvation in Buddhism. It's all about soteriology. All this philosophy, it's not mental masturbation. It is supposed to be serious stuff to take you on this path, a soteriological path, salvation. So how do you put it to use? I mean, what are they trying to do? This is really goes to the chain of causality. This is the strong version. This is the version where you believe in rebirth, and it basically says you're in an infinite rebirth, and you're going to go through junior high school forever, repeatedly, over and over again. You'll never actually get out of junior high school. Every painful experience, you're going to get to do it again and again and again forever. So, you know, this idea of rebirth in Buddhism and in Hinduism is not what we've got in the West. Like, oh, Reaper, wow, dude, regress me back. I know I was a knight. You know, that's not how they see it. They see it as, like, not good. So this is sort of the strong version that would have been there is still there in Buddhist, pure Buddhist monasteries and thinking. And so now you can understand this put-down, this Buddhist put-down. Your mom is like the chain of causality. Now, there's sort of a revised, modern, sort of more secular way that you could kind of tram down this thing, and it doesn't really have the rebirth in it. You can say, well, ignorance gives rise to mental formations, and volitions, craving, pain, grass, and suffering. Now, so, in this, the suffering is this existential discontent. The second arrow idea that every time something bad happens, you anguish about it and make it worse. Alienation, isolation, fear of mortality. It's really basically existential fear of mortality and that constant feeling of needing to do something about something, never really being at peace. And, you know, so all religions are trying to solve that. And in Christianity, they say, well, they have a solution. Christianity has a solution. And so Buddhism says, we have a solution. The ignorance here is basically the ignorance of this whole idea of emptiness, the illusory belief that you are a separate creature and not part of everything. So philosophy is just part of this whole thing, but meditation is also very important. So the I'll show you the Eightfold Path here in just a moment, but the three marks of existence that they feel that one must internalize into the bones, or this idea of suffering and permanence and non-self. And I need to touch upon one thing. There's a popular idea that Buddhism is about not having any passions or not having any desires. And that's not the idea. That idea was there long before the Buddha came. You had these ascetics out there. I mean, you know, there were dime a dozen all over the place. He didn't invent that idea. The idea here, I need to go back here actually, is that it's possible to develop equanimity so that when one has perceptions that may be from the outside world, if there is such a thing, or might be coming thoughts from our minds, that with mental discipline, that one can develop equanimity and not foster the development of mental formations, conditioning, aversion, grasping, clinging. So it's not that you don't, the idea here is it's not that you don't like the thing. You just don't, you can take, you can like it, but if you don't have it, you're fine that way too. So I'm probably not putting that very well, but that's the idea. It's really about interrupting the formation of the creation of mental formations. So what they talk about, the practice in Buddhism, is called purification, where the idea is you're going to try to cleanse your mind of all your conditioning, your mental formations, your volitions, so that you don't have this feeling you need to have this or you must avoid that. It's all fine. It's not the same as not having desires or passions, it's a little different than that. It's about getting the conditioning out. That's what they talk. That's what it's about. So the Eightfold Path really has three components to it: wisdom, ethical conduct, and mental clarity are sort of the three parts of it. So the wisdom part is this right view. We kind of got it mixed up here a little bit here, but let's just say the wisdom part is about understanding. It's a philosophical endeavor. There's the part of it is ethical conduct, and then the practice, the meditation practice, gets you mental clarity and cleansing of these conditions. So,
So the wisdom part is right mindfulness, right concentration. The well, I guess these three, the right livelihood, right action, right speech are the ethical parts. And then right view, right attendance is sort of the wisdom part.
So if I ended without talking about meditation, I'd be leaving something out. So there are basically two goals in Buddhist meditation, and almost two forms of two broad, the many forms of Buddhist meditation, but two sort of broad goals within meditation. And so they can do, so there are different techniques, or they kind of are mutually reinforcing. There's meditation to acquire mental discipline, to not be carried away by the flow of thoughts, but to be more aware, completely aware, of thoughts as they arise. Because what do we do with thoughts? Most of our thoughts are not very original. They are things that come to us from other people, their memories, their whatever, and we're like, we browse, we graze. So one thought leads us to another, and form along your way off over here. You know? So being able to be aware of thoughts as they arise is part of the goal of this whole meditation thing. And insight is then to gain this kind of getting the bones, the marks of existence, the three marks of existence, impermanence, anatta, and suffering, essentially. I'm kind of, that's like in a thumbnail of what they do. So that's the idea behind meditation in a very brief. So now there's some challenges to Buddhism, and I'm about to open this to questions. But I'm a little late, aren't I? So now I want to just do that. I have some of the challenges that people can think about, but really, let's open it to questions.
Let's start. I'll start. You talked about rightness on the Eightfold Path. How does Buddhism define rightness?
Well, in the Eightfold Path,
so right view, right intention. So right view is really everything we just talked about.
Understanding emptiness, understanding all this stuff at an intellectual level. So that's like, you know what, that's the first step in the path. And it's a lot in it, isn't there? So it's a whole bunch of philosophizing to kind of intellectually grasp all that. Right intentions, then, is basically then to really be motivated to want to do something. So now, then, these here are ethical standards. And in Buddhism, yes, there's, you know, they put forth ethical standards that are sort of based on compassion. So, like in every field, really, it's very hard to ultimately substantiate ethical positions. I mean, ethical positions, so like, you know, in Christianity, it's because God ordains this to be what's right. We know, you know, in philosophy, you can track these positions back, and you have a problem ultimately having an original, an origin that's not sort of arbitrary. But they have it. So these are ethical positions. Right livelihood is like this, because in their world, you have rebirth, and you have a commonality between us and dogs and insects and everything, that you should not work as a butcher, for example. And then these, so all this right stuff then is sort of, you know, correct way to do it, meditating properly, you know, that kind of thing.
Yes, Laura?
Yeah, that's the opposite of the Christianity, thou shalt not. That's the thou shalt's.
In a way, yes.
Those are the thou shalt's.
Although there's a lot of knots, because there's like, don't work as a butcher, for example.
What?
Don't work as a butcher. So that's a sort of a thou shalt not.
Thou shalt have right speech.
Yeah, so, yeah, it's stated here, it's stated in the affirmative.
Yeah.
Right.
They're all there.
Yeah.
know, you mentioned some strange results, I think, that we find hard to grasp, and one of them was that movement cannot be possible, because they think of the world in a set of snapshots, and in so doing, they can't get out of that. Now, do you think that might have been just a way of trying to convince people in a Socratic way that they really didn't know what they were talking about, and also in the same way that Zeno's paradox of the tortoise and the hare, you know, the hare could never overtake the tortoise because if the tortoise moved forward so far, if the hare moved forward so far, he was behind, then the tortoise would move further, and then the hare would move some more, and the tortoise would move some more. And looking at it from that perspective, you never found the hare passing the tortoise. That was really meant to say, tell people, you don't, we don't understand things very well, not that what we're saying is true.
I think what you're saying is really correct, I think, in many ways. Throughout Buddhist teaching, he would use sort of convenient or effective teaching devices. So if he had an audience that he thought was less this, he directed to the audience, and they've done that throughout Buddhist teaching. So I think there's some truth to that. And also, this particularly Major Naka school was all about tearing down whatever you wanted to say, any kind of position you had about what reality was. They would just show you how that couldn't be. They really didn't offer an alternative. And then they ended up saying, and you know what? Whatever we just said is really just conceptual and is similarly limited by the concepts. Concepts still don't do it. So emptiness is a concept. That really doesn't stand either. But having said all that, and I know, Brian, that you're very oriented towards science, so Einstein had the position that time is illusory. If there's no time, can there be movement?
Right, but Einstein's been superseded by quantum theory and a whole lot of other things. I mean,
you still have that position that time is illusory.
Right.
So we could debate this one a long time.
Nevertheless, we really have gone a long way beyond these simple paradoxes, and it really is...
we got new ones now.
It's inhibiting on mental thought to dwell on them, I think.
That's the scientific perspective.
This general idea.
Yes.
You began your lecture saying that all common, or everything common with religions is salvation. That's what you very, very first started. So you've heard the phrase, everybody wants to get to heaven, but just not right now. So we all want to think that we can live forever, right?
Right.
So how does everything that you taught us here, let's say if we do everything right, let's pretend you're a Christian and a Buddhist argument. It's like, no, Christianity is right. No, I'm a Buddhist. I'm going to, my way is salvation. Christian will argue my way is salvation. So how does what you just taught us let us think, okay, yeah, this will let us live forever. This is salvation.
Well, part of the problem with that one is that I know exactly what you mean when you say Christian.
Well,
I'm not sure I know exactly what you mean when you say Buddhist. Are we talking about the kind of the strong formulation, rebirth?
Well, again, it's saying Buddhism is a religion because it will lead you to salvation.
Okay, I'm going to answer it. I'm going to answer it in sort of the strong version that is really based on rebirth and karma and these kinds of things.
Right.
So in Buddhism, you have this concept of nirvana. So once you have really fully internalized and not only intellectually but also at a non-intellectual level become in touch with this truth that they cannot tell you what it is because even the emptiness thing falls, you know, that once you do that you have this nirvana thing. Now, there were two kinds of nirvana. It's called cessation. Cessation with remainder, cessation without remainder. Cessation with remainder is you've got it, you're like the Buddha now, but you're not dead yet. Cessation without remainder is, okay, now you're dead. So there's a little interval between.
The bottom line is, what happens if you have this philosophy? What happens to you when you're dead? Do you exist, or are you just a rock that just got smashed?
Okay, so first of all, there's that period between, because those that don't believe in rebirth, that are more like humanist or secular, are going to be focused on that period where they believe there's nirvana and they have it in their life that they'll have it until they die. Those who are going for rebirth, okay, so what they're going to, that's kind of, that is a controversial thing in Buddhism where there have been different viewpoints put forth, and I think basically the answer is they don't really know. They don't really have a position.
This does not necessarily disprove that you will have an afterlife.
No. There are some Buddhists, see, this is where Buddhism breaks into these different things. Okay. So there's like Pure Land Buddhism, and there's some of these Buddhist thoughts that may not really reflect what was original teaching too. But there's this, you know, where you basically go to heaven, you know, the Pure Land. There's others that say, no, you just absorb into the universe. You become, that the idea that you're separate is an illusion. You're just one of the whole thing, and that you will lose the illusory separateness and just be one of the whole thing. Basically, and then when you die, you're still one of the whole thing.
This can be all there is. When you're dead, this is all there is. There's nothing else after this.
Depends on whether you're purely a Buddhist.
Young man, the blue shirt.
Yes.
You were making a lot of like emphasis and implications during your discussion, so I'm wondering if Buddhism has ever been, quote, logically proven, like from start to finish, and if so, why don't we see more pure or abstract mathematicians become Buddhists?
Well, this one is where, what is Buddhism? Because I think there are things in Buddhism, in the traditional early forms of Buddhism, that could not be proven. I don't see how anybody's going to prove rebirth or the idea that, but they tried. They tried to make logic. It's all been about logical arguments. The whole history has been people locked up in monasteries for hundreds and thousands of years with nothing to do and nothing that they're interested in doing other than logically trying to prove this. So it's hard to put it all out in an hour, and in fact, I don't know it all, but the history is all trying to logically show it. I'm not convinced on some of the early assertions like things like rebirth. I'm not convinced that that's
okay.
Something you can
argue. Okay, Bob, and then Ray, and then Jack.
I have two questions. One is, I don't understand why you see it as salvation, which is a Christian concept. I don't see that in Buddhism, because I want to know what the hell I need to be saved from. That's my first question. The second one is, my understanding of Zen is different than the rest of Buddhism. I mean, you didn't touch much on that and make a distinction. Like a Zen koan is to teach you that there is no answer. You know, that there is no reality,
right.
There's nothing.
Right, that's right, yeah, right. Yeah.
So, but can you...
So with Zen koans, generally, whatever context you think you're putting into place to answer it, the context is not really, you know, justifiable. So that's the koan thing, yes. Salvation? Well, okay. So let's take Christianity and Buddhism. Each believes that in our out-of-the-box state, we are in some way estranged from an ideal state, a state that would be better, that we'd be better off not to just stay as we are, that there's something better. So that in Christianity, you know, is in the Garden of Eden. We've been estranged, and we now have the opportunity, a way to be reunited through Jesus Christ. In Buddhism, we are out of the box, in our default state, estranged by illusion. We're so confused and we're surrounded by illusory that our Buddha nature is totally obscured, and we don't experience it. It's suppressed by the illusion. So the ideal state we want to be saved to get to is to nirvana, and the Buddha, the salvation is done by pursuing the path.
But I'm having a hell of a lot of fun without nirvana. I don't want
to. That's one of the challenges I had here. There's a lot of possible intellectual challenges to this whole viewpoint, and each one is a very interesting discussion. That's a very interesting discussion in itself, but it's not time.
Ray, yeah. And then Jack. And then Barbara, and then
yeah.
basically, I think what we have to examine here is what religion is for, particularly Buddhism and when it arose, and I go back to Marvin Harris, where, you know, basically it makes better peasants. And you look at the last feudal kingdom on earth was the Tibet under the Dalai Lama. And what it does, and Martin Harris points this out, is that it helps you put up with stuff that ordinarily you just couldn't put up with, the life of a peasant. For instance, when population densities got to the point to make better peasants, they invented vegetarianism to get rid of old, unproductive people. Because by becoming vegetarian, you lock one-third off lifespan. And so that arose when population densities got to a certain level. In order to produce better peasants and more productive peasants, they had to eliminate the older ones, so they outlawed meat.
Okay, I mean, that's a perspective, but Sartre would have said that you don't have to be a peasant to have existential angst.
Yes.
Right.
That was the point.
Not necessarily.
In a very similar,
okay,
back to the regular Buddhism.
Jack Duncan?
Yeah, so I was just going to comment on the salvation thing, which seems to have a lot of interest in that my understanding of Christian salvation is really not realized until after you die physically here. It's some supernatural something. But
I don't know that that's an accurate I'm not sure that's an accurate thing. A lot of Christians wouldn't necessarily say that. They would say you're saved the moment. They would say that you have a new life. You are born again, and you have a new existence.
The promise of a better
life.
You know, it's like, it depends on which fundamentalist version you...
Like Buddhism. There's a lot of different viewpoints on these things.
You know, but anyway, I'm just saying that there is a life after death, which is part of the result of being saved. Whereas I think there's another version of salvation, if you will, that is more in the present, in that it's kind of tied to enlightenment or knowledge or information. For instance, maybe if I wash my hands really good, I'll get fewer colds. That kind of, or, you know, maybe I understand what makes me happy and unhappy, and I don't do the things that make me unhappy. So there's a version of salvation, if you will, is about, you know, heaven on earth, or reaching a state in a life that we are experiencing.
See, I see Christianity has this, you're born again, you're free of all your angst that you had before you had this born again experience. When you die, you go to heaven. So with Buddhism...
Because I know I'm going to die and go to heaven.
Depends. This is, of course, you know, I mean, Christians would say no, it's because you're reunited with God. You're no longer estranged. But Buddhists also have this point when you're sort of like born again, is when you reach your nirvana, you're not dead yet, and then you...
Okay, Carla, and then we have time for one more question after Carla.
It's my understanding of Buddhism, the goal is to get off the wheel of rebirth, no more karma, on the nirvana, which, and again, I don't know if you did any study or research into the Tibetan Book of the Dead. There are different phases of the bardo in the afterlife, including the hungry ghosts and various things you pass through to get to the clear white light. Is there any of that, anything that you touched on at all?
Well, yeah. So hungry ghosts. That idea goes all the way back. All the way Theravada, Mahayana. All of them have, because that's a karmic result of karma. And yeah, I know it's in Tibetan too. I'm not as familiar with Tibetan Buddhism.
Book of the Dead. I mean, just because I've heard of it. I mean, you could still pass through various phases of hell.
Yeah.
After death, to get to the clear white light.
I'm less familiar with Tibetan Buddhism. I found it too concrete for my taste, so I guess I don't go for it. Yeah, okay.
One last question. Okay, real quick one, right?
Oh, I was just saying, salvation is the opposite. Well, salvation, what we're looking at, salvation is saving us from extinction. And when you're mutually dependent on bread and wine, grapes and wheat, you have to bow to their needs before your own to ensure that you don't become extinct. And it wasn't, in fact, that the earliest religions were totemic religions. And when it got down to about 600 humans 70,000 years ago, only those that were totemic survived.
So if you believe in rebirth, you're not going to become extinct because you're going to have more junior high school experiences. If you don't...
No, but if you put off your own satisfaction for a future life, and you sacrifice yourself for the crops, then, you know, what it is like life insurance. You know,
you're kind of making a social cost. You're talking about it again, sort of its role sociologically.
Right. What does it do on the ground? What does it do? Okay. How does it make better peasants? It's really what it's all about.
But nirvana, the whole purpose of reaching nirvana is to end reincarnation.
Right.
Thank you.
Okay.
If you're secular, if you're a secular Buddhist, you're not thinking you have rebirth, reincarnation, rebirth. You don't really think you're having that. So it becomes more like a goal for this life, a new state of being in this life.
Let's give a round of applause.
Thank you. I enjoyed the
hand-on.
I'd like to look at the evolutionary advantage of religion. What does it do biologically?